All right, so in this lecture, I'll give an overview of experimental Higgs physics. So this is tied to a second part of, say, what we know about electroweak theory. So there'll be a little bit of history and the latest and greatest as of, in fact, now. This might be a little long, so I don't know. I might continue a little bit in the afternoon, and QCD might be shorter. I don't know if it's fine, or I can stop anywhere. In fact, I'm very flexible. Okay. Yeah, the afternoon one could be shorter, and maybe this one a little longer. Anyway, we'll see how it goes. All right, so you've heard that there was a big discovery in 2012, and most of the people here, in fact, were summer students because they camped out basically to get a space in that auditorium at CERN. And there are many things you don't know about this discovery, and this is described here in this paragraph. So the Time magazine thought that perhaps the Higgs boson could be the person of the year. And 20% definitely agreed, which is great, I think. It's interesting. But this little paragraph is a beauty. So it says, Peter Higgs first posited the existence of a particle that causes energy to make the jump to matter. You did not know that. But it was not until last summer that a team of researchers at the LHC, Rolf Hoyer, Joe and Candela and Fabiola Giannotti, at last sealed the deal and in so doing finally fully confirmed Einstein's general theory of gravity. But it continues, the Higgs, as particles do, immediately decayed. There's just one. We found one. To more fundamental particles, but the scientists would surely be happy to collect any honors or awards in its stead. So you will have learned something today. Okay. Yeah, and it's, yeah, okay, I will stop here. So where we're, before the LHC turned on, this is essentially this was the situation. So the in gray here, you have the exclusion from LEP. So LEP searched as much as it could, and as I said before, they were basically running the LHC as hard as they could till the machine was smoking, and they stopped at 115 GeV, didn't find the Higgs. The Tevatron was starting to exclude a region that was not excluded at a higher mass in the decay of WW that I mentioned earlier this week. And then, indirectly, through other measurements, you could, you know, the mass of the top, the mass of the Z, the W, et cetera, you can sort of figure out what is the mass of the Higgs preferred in the standard model given those measurements. And you see that it was around 100 GeV, but within a sigma, so you could go out to 125 and 2 sigma out to 160. So that was the area. So if you look at this plot and you believe in the standard model, then the Higgs had to be here in that range. Yeah.
What was the factor that pushed it down to such a low mass?
Which
what,
one?
What was the indication of being around 90 or so?
Yeah. Oh, for the fits?
Yeah.
I don't have that plot. Maybe I'll add it during lunch. But you can through the, let's go back maybe 20 years. In 92, I remember I was your age, I guess. And people were saying that the mass of the top was 150 plus or minus 25. And that was obtained through a more precise measurement of the mass of the W boson. So if you can measure the mass of the Z very well and the W very well, then through the loops, the ratio of these two masses, you can infer what the mass of the top is. So 95 found the top, it was indeed in that range. And then once you have the mass of the top, there's a weak dependence through of the mass of the top, W, et cetera, that you can use to extract the mass of the Higgs through those masses. and maybe I'll add a slide this afternoon just to show you how it's done. Okay, so that was after 2010. Then from 2010, so these were the limits that that were obtained with this amount of luminosity at the time it was 7 TeV. And you see that the LHC in 2010 did not have the sensitivity to exclude anything. But very quickly, once the machine turned back on again in the summer of 2011, then we were in business. So we were starting to exclude regions at high mass, but also at low mass. So we went down, at least for Atlas, to excluding about 100 GeV. And here, that's prime real estate, as you saw before. We're actually expecting to exclude more, so there was a bit of an excess. And at the end of 2011, so you take the entire data set, it looked like this. So this is a complicated plot, but you see that we were looking in many different channels and final states, you know, ZZ to LL mu nu, ZZ to LLQQ to 4L. And the dotted or dashed lines are the expected exclusions, and the full lines are the observed exclusions. And here you see that we've basically, you know, through one channel or another, excluded just about the whole range below 500 GeV, and that we're hitting very close to 130 here. Now, you can see that, so this is the expected exclusion, for instance, for gamma, the Higgs to gamma. And you see that the observed is, the limit is actually high. So that means that there's a bit of an excess there already. You see that you see a bump also in ZZ, and WW in red is also above the expectation. So we're having trouble excluding that region. To the what? Yeah, I mean, those are fluctuations. So this is likely a downward fluctuation, upward fluctuation, downward fluctuation. So you can say that perhaps this is another upward fluctuation. You know, we'll discuss the gamma channel later, but you'll see that it's basically there's a lot of background in this channel, and you're looking for a little bump on top of this background. So, you know, you'll get fluctuations up and down. Okay, so the highest at that time local excess was 3.5 sigma, which is large. However, when you look over a very wide mass range, you expect to see some fluctuations like we were discussing. And so you need to account for the fact that you've looked at many different places. So if your region of interest, if you limit it to this region, since we had excluded above 146 in the summer, and this is LEP, then it's a 2.5 sigma excess. And over the whole mass range, it's 2.2. Now, I've seen many fluctuations come and go in my time, much larger than this. So it looked potentially interesting. But 2 sigma is not a discovery. But the interesting thing, of course, is that at the end of those results were obtained at the end of 2011, and then we knew in 2012 that we would either kill this excess or it would grow. So it was very exciting because you know that you're on the verge of a big discovery. Either there is no standard model Higgs or there is one. This is what it looked like in 2012 and in July. So the excess indeed grew to reach about 6 sigma at 125 or 126. And this is the same thing for CMS, also with an excess of about 5 sigma at 125. And then we published it together, sent the paper within the same few minutes to physics letters B, make sure that nobody scoops the other. Okay, so this is a bit of a summary of what I just said. Now, the title of the paper when we published this was Observation of a New Particle in the Search for the Standard Model Higgs Boson. So that's not much of a commitment in terms of what you've found, right? We were looking for the Higgs boson and we found a new particle. But then after July, the LHC delivered four times the data that was used at the for the discovery. And so with the full data set, we presented some results in March 2013, both ATLAS and CMS. And then CERN, in a press release, said that we had found a Higgs boson. And so shortly after, two important ATLAS papers followed, where we measured the, compared various scenarios for the spin of the particle, showing that spin zero is preferred, and we'll take a look at that in a second. And the other was that it coupled to bosons, as expected. Need to remember that at the time of Higgs, he was looking for giving mass to the weak, the charged weak boson, the W. Yeah. Well, at that time it was basically driven by the machine. So the machine was running, I believe, until I have some chronology at the end. Maybe I'll show it to you what happened. But the machine stopped around the 15th of June. So they have like technical stops to take care of the LHC. So we decided that we would wait until the 15th and then look. And we had potential sensitivity at that point. In general, if you have enough sensitivity for evidence, which that's normally three sigma, then we can unblind. So in the last 2 years, after these two papers, the LHC shut down. And so right now the energy is running at 13 TeV. As of this morning, we have 100 inverse picobarns. I think yesterday I said we had 40, but it's accumulating fast. So it's running well. But during that time, we worked pretty hard actually. So the data were reanalyzed to recalibrate the various subdetectors, and we learned a lot about how to deal with pileup. And we had more time to do the analysis and reduce our systematics. So the results are much better than the ones that we presented in 2013 that I will show you a bit later. And some of the results that I will show you are relatively fresh. So we saw this earlier this week. Those are the main production mechanisms and the cross-sections at 125 GeV. So this one is the dominant one, gluon fusion. And then you go to vector boson fusion, but the cross-section is about 1/10. And now we have some papers coming out also for this production mechanism, which has a tiny cross-section, but this provides a pretty spectacular final state with the top providing, say, Ws, the Higgs can decay to Ws. You have leptons flying everywhere in jets. But I won't discuss TTH much today. Okay, so the first thing that you need is a mass. So as you see, if you want to make some measurements or test the standard model, you need as input the mass. So you have here the branching ratio as a function of mass, and you see that it's changing quickly, especially in the region of interest here. So what's happening is that the W bosons and the Zs are off shell in this region. At least one is off shell. And as you reach twice the mass, then you see that it completely dominates at 180. So as this one is rising, BB is going down. Why BB is higher? It's because it's the heaviest particle that the Higgs can decay to in that range. So once you make a precision measurement, then you have a bunch of predictions, right? So it says that the BB you should get 57% of the time. This is about 4%, et cetera, et cetera. And WW is 22%. And we have these two that are pretty small. So this is 2 order 2 per mil for gamma-gamma. Okay, and I think I mentioned this. So around a mass of 125 GeV, the cross-section doesn't change much, the production cross-section per GeV, but the branching ratios for WW and ZZ are changing quite rapidly. So it's important to have a pretty good measurement of the mass here, right? So if you're only, if your precision is 1 GeV, then you can't do better than this. But our precision is much better than 1 GeV, as you can tell here. I think I have the combination on the next slides, or the two measurements. So this is the ATLAS measurement. So our initial measurement for the ZZ channel was this. We'll get 124, and you'll notice that this statistical uncertainty is about half a GeV, and the systematic is about half a GeV again. And just to show you that we worked pretty hard, you can see that the systematic uncertainty on the mass shrunk by almost a factor of 10. Statistical is basically the same. So now we're statistically dominated. Okay, so the more Zs we get, we'll improve the measurement. And same thing for gamma-gamma. Our systematic uncertainty was 700 MeV, and we shrunk it by a factor of 2 or 3. During a shutdown. Basically here it's a knowledge of the calibration of the muon momentum that's driving this. We had some problems also with the calibration of the calorimeter that were solved and during that time. So because we knew that there were some issues, potential issues, which is why the systematic was relatively large. But here, what you want is a good measurement of the electron and muon momenta and energy. So this is for CMS. So they have a nice peak also. And this is their peak in gamma-gamma. This is the background subtracted. And the result is given here. So we've combined the two measurements now. So in blue you have the ZZ channels, and in red the gamma gamma. And everything combined is given here. So at the end of the day, we have a 0.2% measurement of the mass, which is pretty impressive, and we'll get better. And here you have the various channels and their combination. Okay, so we have a mass. Now we can go on and make a bunch of interesting measurements. So we want to measure the couplings. So in various. So we study various production modes. The ones that I mentioned before, we have 5 production modes. We have these decay modes that we can look at, and some rare decay modes. So mu mu and z gamma that we're searching for. And this one is very challenging. You might not see it at the LHC, but we're trying to. We can measure the quantum numbers of the Higgs, its spin and CP properties, and start making fiducial and differential measurements of the production of the Higgs and its decay. We can also try to measure its width. Now, the width of the Higgs, I don't have a plot here, but it's very, very narrow. It's 4 MeV at 125 GeV. And so we can't measure this with our detector, just measuring the width. And so we need to make some assumptions. We can try the direct way, but we will be far away. We will be within a few GeV is the resolution of the detector. But there are other ways of trying to get at the width. Okay, so I'll walk you through the various measurements for the main channels. Okay, so for gamma-gamma, the dominant production, of course, is the one that we mentioned, GGF. The difficulty here is that it sits on a very large background. So you have a tiny Higgs signal, as you saw before. And so you need very good photon identification to make sure that you reject fake leptons as much as possible. Now, our EM calorimeter was designed with this signal in mind. Okay, so we ran simulations in the 90s, and it was designed to find such a channel. In fact, it's kind of nice that that the Higgs sits where it does, because we can measure this decay, for instance. If you look at, if I just go back a few slides, you see that gamma-gamma is going down quickly. So had the Higgs been a bit heavier, wouldn't have seen it, but the people who built the calorimeter can now actually look at real Higgs decays to gamma-gamma. So another problem with this is that it has a small branching ratio, so you need quite a bit of integrated luminosity to see a signal. But it's a very good discovery final state, because we have good mass resolution. You're looking for a resonance on top of a smooth background. So unlike the WW signal that we looked at with a bunch of different backgrounds and systematics, here it's just basically a smoothly falling background and you're looking for a bump. So it's hard to get this wrong, although you can, but it's hard. And it's interesting also because it probes new physics in loops. So the Higgs couples to massive particles, and it turns out that the gluon and the photon are massless. And so it needs to couple to the gluon indirectly through loops. In this standard model, the heavy particle that you can put here that is colored is the top quark. It's very heavy. And there are contributions from all colored particles, but this loop is dominated by the top quark. On the decay side, you need a charged particle to emit photons. And so the two particles that the Higgs likes, massive and charged, would be the top quark and the W. This loop is, in fact, mostly dominated by the W in the standard model. But you have interference effects also with the top quark. Now, if you have another particle that is colored that couples to the Higgs, then it can circulate here if it couples to the Higgs. So you can change the production cross-section, could go up or down if you have something else going on in that loop. Or if you have a charged particle beyond the standard model that is charged, couples to the Higgs, then it could influence the decay rate here. Through interference, it could go up or down. So this is a particularly interesting channel to search for non-standard couplings of the Higgs. So in those 2 years where we were working on this analysis, we refined the energy calibration. So we improved the energy resolution by 10%. And the uncertainty on the resolution, so the uncertainty on that resolution was improved by a factor of 2. Our experimental systematics were reduced. So the analysis also sensitivity was improved. We retuned the selections and categorization. What I didn't say is between the period where the first papers came out and these, we reblinded the analysis because we redid all the calibration and started playing around with the selections. And you don't want to bias yourself when you're retuning selections and looking at a signal. Right? So all this was improved, and so this is a nice little bump. So this shows you how the categorization for this channel looks like. So the first selection is for just two photons, high PT photons. And then you see if you have any evidence for TTH production. So here you would have jets that would be B tag because the top decays to a W and a B. One of the tops would go leptonically. If it doesn't pass these selections, you see if it could be hadronic, consistent with tops. If not, you continue and look at all the different production mechanisms. If it has two jets, for instance, here, then it could be classified as VBF. And if it fails all this, then it's probably gluon-gluon. And then you go into further categorization where you you look at where the photons went and what was the trans. Well, okay, so this quantity here, PTT, is the transverse momentum relative to the thrust axis. But the message here is that the categorization that I mentioned yesterday also happens for all these channels. So this shows the PTT above. Okay, so this is the estimated signal composition in various categories. And you can see how clean various categories are. So let's take just a look at these two. So VBF tight means that you have tight selections. And you see that we think that the composition would be mostly through VBF production and a little bit of GGF. If you relax it, then you get more of gluon fusion. Okay, so when you combine all of these channels together, and you use our measured mass, the ATLAS measured mass, you get this result for the signal strength. Just to remind you that the signal strength is the ratio of what you've observed over the standard model prediction. So that one would be you get the standard model, two, you get twice the standard model, and 1.17 means that you get a 17% over the prediction, but the uncertainty is 27.27. So it's compatible with one. And here you see the various measurements in the different categories. And this is a VBF versus a GGF. This is the standard model here that sits at 1.1. And this is what we measure. And these are 1 sigma contours and 2 sigma contours. Okay, so let's turn to ZZ. So this is also an excellent discovery final state because the backgrounds are very low. Again, you get a very good mass resolution. You reconstruct all the decay products. But you're kind of suffering here because you get very few events, basically. You're requiring that the Zs decay to 2 leptons. And so this requires very good lepton reconstruction efficiencies. You want to be as efficient as possible to get more signal. It's easy in this channel to cope with a high pileup environment because you have 4 leptons and you can do kinematic reconstruction. You can point to a vertex. So it's pretty straightforward. It's a clear and robust signal of a Higgs coupling to something, to the Z. Okay, so again, in this channel, we went through a bunch of improvements to get a better resolution, but also try to deal with occasional final state radiation photons. We use a multivariate discriminant for the GGH category. We improved the background estimates, and we added a few categories. So the categorization looks a little bit like the one for gamma-gamma. You start by requiring 4 leptons, and then you ask, do I have 2 jets? If so, it could be VBF enriched. You ask for a cut on the invariant mass of those 2 jets. If the invariant mass is low, then it could be associated production, where the W goes to 2 jets or the Z goes to 2 jets. If you don't have jets, but you have an extra lepton, it could also be associated production. And if not, then you have GGF. Now for GGF, we have a BDT that has these variables. And this is to reduce the dominant ZZ background. Okay, so this is what you expect for the signal as a function of the mass. So the signal, of course, would be near 125. And this is the BDT score. -1 is background-like, 1 is signal-like. So the signal sits here. And the background, the ZZ background, as you can see, there's not a lot of background here. Okay, so this is the estimated signal composition in various categories. And you see one problem here with the VBF enriched is that we had to use very, very low cuts for the mass of the two jets. And so you don't get a lot of VBF. In fact, it's still quite enriched in GGF. So as we get more data in run two, we'll be able to use more stringent cuts and clean up this category. This category is super clean, so it's it will be nice to get. So the result here, when you put all these channels together, is given here. So it's 1.44 with this statistical uncertainty and this systematic uncertainty, so it's dominated by statistics. It's a little high, but still easily compatible with the standard model value of 1. And you see where the various events fall here. So you have some very background-like events, and you have some very signal-like events at high BDT score and at around 125. This is an example of a four muon candidate, so of four muons that come out. A pair of those two will have the mass of the Higgs. The other mass of the Higgs, the mass of the Z, and the other would come from an off-shell Higgs, so the mass will not peak. And when you put all of them together, in this particular example, I took out the mass, but it was close to 125. Here's another one. Here it's 4 electrons. The 4 electrons hit the calorimeter, and you see the energy deposits here. Okay, and we can do, with these channels, you have the, you can reconstruct the entire event, as I mentioned before. So we've started to make measurements of the differential cross sections, so for various variables. So we can look at the PT of the Higgs. So this is a PT of the gamma-gamma system. And this is versus the number of jets. And this is the PT of the 4-lepton system, or the PT of the Higgs again. You can see that perhaps there's some excess, or this might become interesting in run two. Or it might be a problem with the way that we model.
Hmm? PT of the gamma system.
Yeah, yeah.
With the PT of the Higgs.
Yeah.
Did you try to produce this plot away from the Higgs mass?
We could, yeah. So these are standard model. You can standard model measurements. You can take a look.
You don't actually know which one of those events is Higgs on that, right? Because
no, that's right.
You're putting a window at 125.
Yeah.
So it could just be that the background is
not. It cannot. Well, the background cannot be high everywhere, because essentially we're not making a. If the way this is done is that we're fitting the background, and so the background will adjust itself to this fit, so it cannot be high.
Right? So you're fitting the background in very
much. Yeah.
It could be the background.
In that variable, yeah, you're right. So it could look like this. In fact, you need one bin that's low and one bin that's high. Yeah, it would be interesting to make that plot.
Why does that look very significant? Well, when you quote signal strength for the Higgs again, it seems like it's within a sigma. I mean, I've seen people quote the signal strength. It didn't seem like it was very different, but that looks like a huge deviation.
Yeah, well, it's not that large. So it depends which process you look at for this. So the final combination is 1.17. If we go back.
When you look at the error bars, and we're looking at like less half a sigma, so but there looks like much more significant.
Yeah, it is. It's a bit more significant. In fact, it depends on the value that you use. Well, I'll come back to this because the one in our initially our first results were kind of high. At the end of 2013. And then we went through a recalibration and it brought things down. But it depends a little bit how you categorize. So the mu here for those events is higher than the combination.
We're looking at like six bins, all a sigma above the line or something, right? The more, so I would think that would like...
No, but... So this is normalized, right? Then you have this bin that is low. And so the mu is the integral of all of this. So we've looked at many other variables, and here you can see the mean. Well, let's just stick to the left-hand side. So the prediction here is at one, or the measurement, I should say, is at one, and various predictions are colored with their uncertainties for all these variables. So this is the first moment and the second moment, so that's the mean. See that in general, things are relatively in good agreement. There are some, though, that are a bit off, right? And so we'll need to, the uncertainties are still relatively large. But within a year or two, this is gonna shrink. So we'll see how well we do for all these variables. So the third Di boson channel is WW. So we went through this one before, so I'll skip it or go through. Just to state that here the mu is 1.08 with quite small uncertainties. So the statistical here, you get lots of events. So it's much better in terms of statistical uncertainty compared to ZZ. But we need to beat down on systematics because you need to understand all of those backgrounds. Now we switch to fermions. So we've established, all of the previous channels are now about above 5 sigma individually for each of the Di bosons. So now we want to know if the Higgs couples to fermions. There's indirect, of course, evidence because, the fact that we're measuring everything close to one means that, and that this is the dominant production mechanism, means that the Higgs is probably coupling to the top quark as we expect. But we'd like to get a direct measurement. So the first channel that I'll discuss is BB. So here the decay will depend on the coupling to the B quark, which is a down type quark. And we'd like to measure the coupling to down type fermions and up type fermions. They could be different in some models. For instance, in two double models, you can have different couplings for leptons or quarks or up type fermions or down type fermions. And the MSSM is a subset of a 2HDM model. So now the challenge here is that you're decaying to two jets, right? And the LHC is full of jets. So that's the talk for this afternoon, lots of jets. And so you need to clean it up some way. And so what we do is we look for it in the decay with the associated production with a vector boson. Then this vector boson, we can look for leptons from a W or a Z, or even the Z decaying to two neutrinos, in which case what you see are like two boosted jets and missing transverse energy. But it's still a very challenging signal. It's very important that we measure this decay because most of the branching ratio at 125 goes to B quarks. And when we do our fits, we need that input, but it's just difficult to do. So you get very large backgrounds from W and Z plus jets. The Higgs mass resolution is not that good because the jet energy resolution is not as good as the one you get for photons. It requires very good B tagging efficiency, and you need to reject fakes. So you really want to make sure that these guys are Bs and not fake bees. So the analysis proceeds in three different channels. One is zero lepton, where the Z decays to two neutrinos. One lepton, it's a W going to a lepton, and a Z going to two leptons. And we have two categories just to, that have different purities. One is, this is the PT of the vector boson that is coming out. Greater than 100 GeV will be cleaner, and less than 120 GeV. We have two jet bins. So normally you expect two jets, right, from the Higgs, but you can get a third one from radiation. So we use a third jet bin. And then we have some discriminating variables that are put into a boosted decision tree. And we're also using a multivariate b-tagging algorithm. So relative to the previous result, here we had a 50% improvement in sensitivity compared to the one that we had at the end of 2012. Okay, there are some challenges here for the modeling of the dominant background, which is a vector boson plus jets. So if you compare, when you look on this scale, you see how many, I mean, it's a nice plot. It appears to be agreeing well, but when you do the this ratio, you see that you're off by a few percent. So the simulation is off. So what we do is a reweighting of those events to flatten this distribution. And when we do that, we look at another variable, which is the delta phi of the two jets that we don't reweight. But through this reweighting, we see that it flattens this distribution. Okay, so the BDT relies on a good description of the input variables and their correlation. So we consider these variables that we put in the BDT. We discussed the BDT yesterday. And this shows one of them for the zero lepton. This is the delta R between the two jets and the mass, or MBB, sorry. And this is delta R. So the fit model is quite complicated. So we have 11 control regions in our fit where you're normalizing various backgrounds. There are 27 signal regions and 170 nuisance parameters. So those are the systematic uncertainties that are being fit with the rest, with everything. And main systematic uncertainties come from the composition of the W plus B or C and their shapes, and the parton shower and the jet energy resolution. So improving the Monte Carlo modeling here is very important for run two. So we can take a look at the results. Now, it's interesting here that we can test how well we're doing using a fit to V and Z. So instead of the Higgs, you can put the Z here. The Z does decay to BB at 90 GeV. And so you can see if your model works by doing essentially the same fit. And this is what is shown here. Okay, so when we do this measurement, this is the result that we get. So normally we should expect one. You see that it's a little low, but not enough to worry about anything. And so once you can show that things are consistent, then you unblind and you take a look at the results. And here the signal strength is measured to be a little low, so 0.5, but still consistent with one. And we have a separate cut-based analysis that does not use the multivariate or the BDT, and here you have 0.65. Okay. So here's an image of such an event with two B-tag jets and two electrons coming from likely a Z boson. Okay, so the last channel that I'll discuss is Higgs going to tau tau. So here, it's interesting because you can measure how the Higgs couples to leptons, but also uptype fermions directly. And the cross-section times branching ratio is relatively high. Of all the, so this is the third one. You have BB, WW, and then tau tau. But it's a challenging final state because you have large backgrounds. So taus tend to decay hadronically, so they look like narrow jets. If they decay leptonically, then they emit a lot of neutrinos, so the reconstruction is not like the one you had for a Z, where you can, you basically, if you do the invariant mass, you see a peak at 125. And here, we look in particular, or use VBF production. And when we look at GGH, we ask for an extra jet to boost the system. So this cleans up the event. And this channel is more sensitive, sorry, to pileup. So that was an extra challenge in 2012 when the luminosity went up significantly. Okay, there are three analyses in this channel depending on how the tau decayed. So it can decay to two taus. The two taus decay hadronically. One tau decays to a muon and the other hadronically, or just all leptonically. And the main discriminating variables is the tau-tau mass. And we use a special algorithm to improve this reconstruction. We use the fact that, like I mentioned before, that we have less background when we ask for a high PT of the tau-tau system. And for the VBF topology, we ask that there be two jets, that they be well separated and have a high invariant mass. And you see here what it looks like for the signal. So when you ask for forward, so this is the delta eta between the two jets. So that means that the angle between them is large. One is going forward, the other is going backward. And you see that the signal, you have a signal-rich region there. Okay, so here are the results. So here we measured 1.4 with these uncertainties. Again, this is compatible, though a little high, but compatible with 1. And the significance is 4.5 sigma with 3.5 expected because the mu is a little higher. We got a bit more signal than we anticipated. This shows the bins are most signal-rich bins in the end. And you see the contribution from the Higgs here, which is significant, and this is the BDT output for the various channels. You see that for VBF, all hadronic, there's a nice excess here too, and here it's more modest. So this is one example of a tau-tau decay. Okay, we've also looked at the rare decays, so in particular mu-mu. So this is a log plot. This is the signal. And so you see that you're completely swamped by Drellian, so production of two leptons. But if you wait long enough, you know, you should see some peak appear. And so we proceeded to set limits. So this is a limit on the signal strength. And at 125, it's about 7, so we're far away from seeing the signal. However, it's interesting that we haven't found anything, right? Because if this was a Z and not a Higgs, you would expect universal coupling. So if we see the tau, we must see the mu. We don't see the mu here. So this is what we expect. And we'll see how long it takes before we have evidence. It might be in the next 3 years. Another interesting final state is Z gamma. So this proceeds through loops also, so new physics could be involved. And here the limit is 11 times the standard model. So this one, if we have a standard model Higgs, we will eventually see. We just need to take more data. Okay, so this covered the the signal strength, or how many signals we saw. But the other thing that we want to test is whether we've really discovered a scalar particle, so a spin zero particle. Spin zero should not care about direction at all. Okay, so if you produce the Higgs, say at rest in the middle of the detector, it should decay isotropically, or if it decays, say, to the two gammas. Now, this is skewed by the fact that we have selection cuts, and so, but we can still test for various hypotheses. So for ZZ, you have a full reconstruction of the event, because you have everything you need. So you have the two Zs, the decay, the Higgs decays to two Z bosons, and then the four leptons. And so you can reconstruct five different angles and test for this CP properties of the Higgs. For gamma-gamma, you're a bit limited because you're not measuring, say, the polarization of those bosons. They're not decaying, but you can use the angle cosine theta in this frame. And for WW, unlike ZZ, you don't have all the information. You only have two leptons, and the neutrinos are missing ET. So you have less information. However, you do have more events, so you can use that. So the delta phi between the two leptons is shown here for the spin zero hypothesis. And here you see those colors is for a spin two particle, and the background is in black. Interestingly, for the discovery, we were looking for a standard model Higgs boson, which looks like this. When we do this analysis for the spin, we need to change the cuts because we had cut, if you remember from yesterday, probably not, but we had cut on delta phi LL. You know, this is a signal-rich area. But now we need to relax those cuts if we want to be able to distinguish between the various hypotheses.
For Higgs, it's easy. You have five angles, but do you really reuse all of them? Like, or do you just integrate all the angles by one or something?
Yeah.
Do you really look for, like, how do you use all of them? Like, how is that?
I'll the next slides. You'll get a better idea. Okay, so we being CMS and Atlas, we ran different. We looked for different hypotheses or compared different alternative hypotheses to the standard model prediction. So the standard model prediction is a pure CP even scalar, not a pseudo scalar. That would be CP odd. And so what we do is we test those kinematic distributions. We compare whether it favors zero plus compared to something else. And all the results favor zero plus over almost all spin one, spin two variants. At more than 95% confidence level. It's often 99.99 or 99.9. So you see this here. So this is the observation. When it hits the dark orange, it means that it's compatible with zero plus. And you see that it's quite compatible. And these are the alternative hypotheses. Okay, so dark blue is within one sigma, and light blue is three sigma. And you see that in some cases, you're far away. You're excluding this hypothesis by a lot. So this is one minus, this is one plus, and a lot of that are at three sigma. And those are different values, are different alternative models of spin two. I think we've done enough spin. Spin two would be really far-fetched. So, but you know, you need to do it once. So I think we're done with these spin two and run two. So now we're going to do something else. And here are the results from Atlas for zero plus. This is a pseudoscalar. And you see that's very compatible with the standard model and not compatible with the alternative. So So the next step for us is that for all practical purposes, we've excluded spin 1 directly through ZZ and WW. And in fact, spin 0 should not be able to decay to two photons. If it had spin 1 particle should not be able to decay to two photons. So theoretically, it's excluded. Experimentally, it's excluded. Spin 2 would be quite exotic, so I think we're done with that. A pure pseudoscalar is also excluded. But what could happen is that we could have in the couplings some contributions from new physics that introduce a little bit of these components of CP odd or something else. And so you'll see the two different formalisms here, but in general, what we're considering is a general Lagrangian or effective theory where you put in all the terms that could be allowed, and then you start to test for various values. And this is what CMS did here in Atlas. It's sort of a different framework where you have the various couplings. So just to give you an idea, for a standard model Higgs boson, if you look at this this Lagrangian here, KSM is 1 and the others are 0. If you have a pure CP odd 0 minus state, then these two are 0. And AVV, which is, where is it? Right there. What? Should be here. AVV, KAVV. Right, so AWW or AZZ, those two should be 1, and the other is 0. Okay, so this is for the pure case, but there could be some component or smaller component of this value. So it could be not 1, but the smaller. So we're trying to now go below this value of 1 that we've excluded and try to exclude other values in this context. Okay, so that was for the spin. So we're pretty convinced that it's a zero, a spin zero plus particle that could have still some components coming from new physics at a higher scale, but it looks like a nice standard model Higgs boson. So what we try to do then is put all of the measurements that you've seen together in one big fit and try to extract couplings. Okay, fundamentally, what we measure is just a number of events, right? So the number of signal is the product of the production cross-section, the branching ratio, the acceptance, the efficiency for reconstruction, for reconstructing things times the luminosity. Okay, so through all these measurements, fundamentally it comes from a certain number of events that you've measured. Okay, so this is our fundamental measurement, and we need to extract the signal yields, which means that you need to understand the background. So this is an example for WW, you need to understand all these things. Now in those measurements, as I mentioned yesterday, we assume that we only have standard model backgrounds. There's nothing else in there. There was something else, then it would impact our Higgs results indirectly. So we would potentially get erroneous results just because we were missing a background. Okay, so this I had before. So you need to take care of the background. The other complication is that we measure some signal strength after a bunch of selections. So we try to tag the production modes. But as I mentioned before, those production modes are not extremely clean. And so you have, when you fit for VBF enrich, you're getting some other category. But in the fit, you can resolve all of this together. Okay, this we saw. So here are the results for the production signal strength when we put everything in the fit. Okay, so this is a result for gluon production And as the value of one here is the standard model prediction, so you get 1.23 within a sigma of one. VBF is also a little high, compatible, and VH a little low, compatible. TTH is a bit higher. And CMS also very compatible. So the two channels that are potentially a little high, TTH, might become interesting. So TTH is a channel that if you had, I don't know, new physics or supersymmetry, you could get extra events that are not Higgs. And this could translate into a high value of the coupling, but we'll have to see with more data what happens here. So another thing that we can do is calculate the production ratios for each final state. So we can cancel the branching ratios. Okay, so if you use, for instance, WW, you can or two final states that go to WW, then you can make a measurement of VBF where this cancels. Okay, so this is what you see here for CMS. So this is the ratio of VBF and VH, so couplings to WW compared to GGH and TTH. And this is the result. And on the right, the same thing for Atlas, for this ratio. And this is the combined, which is quite compatible with one again. And this is in terms of plots. So this is the VBF significance for CMS is 3.7 sigma, and for Atlas is 4.3. And we're in the process of combining the results of CMS and Atlas. So in the next 2 months, you will have a combined result from the LHC from the Run 1 data set. So this point here is the standard model. You see that everything is consistent again. This is the 1-1 point for Atlas. Okay, now we can look at the decay modes. So you run this fit and in various production modes, and you extract the values. So we've seen some of those during the talk. You see that they're quite compatible. Mu mu and Z gamma, we're not sensitive yet. And this is the combined value for Atlas, which is 1.18 plus or minus 0.15. Okay, so we're at the level of 15%, and we're within roughly a sigma. For CMS, interestingly, they got a value of 1.00 with an error of 15% also. Okay, I think I'll finish with this couplings framework. So what we've done up until now is extract these production strength, but what we're really after are the couplings of the Higgs to a given particle. Okay, and this is illustrated here in this Lagrangian. So we have a framework we call the Kappa framework, where the signal strength parameters, so this is the mu at production, and this is the mu at the branching ratio, are further interpreted in terms of modifiers to the standard model couplings. Okay, so the production, for instance, would go like this. So a kappa of one means that you've seen the standard model, and you have a square here. Just to reflect that when you would do the calculation, you'd get this value squared. There are some assumptions in this coupling framework. One is that you have only one Higgs, that you're dealing with standard model production and decay kinematics, that you have the tensor structure of the SM, that it's a zero plus scalar, and that the resonance is narrow. Now, in this framework, you can encode these loops or the interference you get through loops into effective couplings, kappa gamma and kappa g. So kappa gamma will be this coupling to gluons and anything that could circulate in this loop. And kappa G and kappa gamma on the gamma side. And so as an example, the production sigma times branching ratio for this mode over what you expect in a standard model would be given by these kappa values. And in terms of SM coupling modifiers in the loop in the standard model, you have some contribution from the top and the B and the interference between the two. And you see that the top completely dominates the B. On the decay side for gamma, you have the contribution from the W from the top and the interference between the two. You see that top is relatively small, but there's a significant interference term. And as I mentioned before, BSM particles that are colored or charged in the loops could cause some deviations. So it could change these modifiers, these kappas. So what we can do is measure the absolute couplings. Okay, so we have some assumptions here. And as we go along, we'll relax the assumptions. So here you can, one assumption you can make is that there are no contributions to the width from BSM particles. If there were, then the Higgs could be wider, and there are no contributions to loops from BSM particles either. And you try to see if things are consistent with the couplings you expect in a standard model for all those particles. So this is the coupling to W bosons, Z bosons, top B, tau, and mu. See that they're nicely compatible, and the same thing here for Atlas. You'll notice that we can consider a negative sign. And we have sensitivity to the negative sign because or the relative sign between, say, the coupling of the vector and the fermion here. Because if the relative sign was negative, this becomes a plus. So it increases the cross-section. Okay, we can test the gauge versus Yukawa coupling. So we put all the bosons together and all the fermions together. And here the assumptions is that there's a common scaling factor for all fermions and all gauge bosons. So we have KF and KV. And again, no BSM contributions. Again, the results are compatible with the SM. You notice that on the negative side here, the various channels do not intersect, but they all nicely intersect in this positive quadrant. And 1-1 is the standard model. And this is the same thing for CMS. So 1-1 standard model, this is what they measured. Another thing you can do is check for up and down couplings, or the ratio between the couplings to down-type fermions and up-type fermions. And this is motivated by what I mentioned before, the two Higgs doublet scenarios. And MSSM is one example of a two Higgs doublet model, a special case. And you see that, again, the ratio is compatible with one. We have some trouble resolving the sign ambiguity, and CMS just looked at the positive side, compatible with one. You can do the same thing for lepton quark couplings. So the ratio of the couplings to leptons, to quarks, again, compatible with one. And then you can ask whether there's potentially new physics in the loops. So you can test for heavy BSM physics, so where the particles would be heavier than half the mass of the Higgs. So that means that the Higgs cannot decay to them, with possible contributions to GGH in the production side or the decay side for gamma-gamma. And so here you assume no contributions to the width from BSM particles because of this. And you assume that you assume SM tree-level couplings for the known particles. So what that means is you, if you assume that the W has the value of the standard model, but you want to test whether there's something else in the loop, you put one for the W and then you test. So this is sensitive to production and decay, new physics in the loops. You see that it's quite compatible, again, with one. And the same thing here for CMS. So 1-1 is the standard model, and they're within one sigma. Now you can relax this assumption that we made, that the Higgs, that the BSM particles need to be heavier than MH over 2. So here you let them go. So you relax the assumption of the width, and this is what you get. So you can get a limit on the branching ratio of the Higgs going to invisible particles. And the direct limit from CMS is shown here. So this is potentially interesting because if the Higgs couples to some particle that could be dark matter, it could decay to it if the mass is below MH over 2. And then you would have some invisible branching ratio of the Higgs. And right now we have limits, as you can tell, of order 30% or so. Okay, so then you can relax the assumptions that we made on the standard model couplings of known particles, and then you can consider various scenarios. So the blue squares here are models where you have Higgs singlets or doublets, where you enforce that the kappa or the couplings to vectors is less or equal to 1. Okay, so you impose this constraint on the fit. The orange circles are, you add off-shell measurements, assuming on-shell equal to off-shell coupling. So this will put a limit on the width of the Higgs. And I don't think I have time to go into this. And then the green diamonds are where you impose no contribution to the width from BSM particles. Okay, so in general, again, you can see how well you do and what the error bars are for the various scenarios, but everything is nicely consistent. Finally, you can do the most general fit where you have no assumptions on the particle contents in loops, no assumptions on the BSM decay or Higgs width. The drawback, if you do this, is you can only fit ratios. You cannot get the coupling. So lambda WZ means the ratio of the coupling of the W to the Z. BZ is B to the Z, B to Z, etc. So you do all these ratios. And of course, these ratios should be 1 in the context of the standard model. And you see the results. Again, it's quite compatible. And this is a bit high. This is for top because of TTH that we saw before. And then these are the results for Atlas. Okay, one thing, so this is a bit of a PR plot where you compare, where you plot the particle mass and the coupling for fermions, and it's different, of course, for vector bosons. You kind of cheat to put them on a line, but at least the fermions, it's fine to put them on a line. So you see what you get for Atlas. So this is what you expect for other Higgs. Right. And as I mentioned before, universal couplings, they would be here. You see that they're not. And the top is up here, very massive particle, and same thing for CMS. Okay, I think I'll stop here. I have a bit more. Maybe I'll continue for 15 minutes in the afternoon and switch to QCD. But I'll conclude with this slide for now. So the Run 1 physics program covered a wide array of measurements and searches, and now it's essentially complete. Run 2 has started, and we're trying to finish all our all our papers, the last paper that will come out is probably this combination of the Atlas and CMS results. We've measured various properties in terms of the spin CP and in production properties of the particle that we found. And as you could tell, it's quite consistent with the standard model up to some precision, maybe between 15% and 40%, some channels we haven't seen. So the challenge now for many of these channel is that we need to go to higher precision, so beyond 15%. And this will require a lot of effort in terms of improving our experimental techniques, but also the Monte Carlo generators and the theory calculations. So some of them are kind of limiting at this point for both the signal, but also for many of the backgrounds. We need, you know, we put all these things in big boosted decision trees and multivariate techniques, but that asks a lot of the Monte Carlo generators. They need to model the signal very well. If it doesn't make sense to use these fancy algorithms. So we have a very exciting and challenging Higgs physics program for Run 2 that just started, in fact. Okay, any questions? Yeah.
Is there any analysis on multi-generation?
You're the only one in the public. Oh, yeah. Yeah, so here I haven't, maybe in the slides this afternoon, I'll add it. Since I was supposed to talk about the standard model experimental, I have no BSM. But in our Higgs group, we have of order 40 analyses that look for beyond a standard model Higgses. So in the context of two doublets, we're trying to see singlets, exotic decays of the Higgs. So the best way to show that this Higgs is not the standard model Higgs would be to find another Higgs. So this is the hard way. The hard way is measuring the couplings down to a few percent. The easy way is to find a new Higgs boson. But we have. We're certainly looking hard for them. And it's a big part.
Hmm? To say the
least. Yeah.
What are the effect of Lagrangians that happen in CMS? Do they assume CP conservation? Whether they like their smaller couplings are real?
No. You don't need to. But, well, you can make various assumptions. Eventually, when you have a lot of data, you'll be able to play with the various terms. Right now, the error bars are often quite large. Yeah, you had a question.
So, I had a question about when you were doing these puts, when you constrain a count to be less than one, that was correct, that slide. So, I might have missing something there, but you're constraining a count to be less than one, so why are some of the puts giving you for the vectors count as greater than one? Do you actually have a put?
Why they go, well, this is that's a good point. kappa V, kappa W. Yeah, in principle, that's a good question. I mean, all the values, that's a good question. The question is, if you force kappa V to be less than one, why those are blue? Why are kappa Z and kappa W? Well, this one in particular. Here, I could just say that it's just that you didn't cut off the error, but here it's above one. I'll try to answer that question by the afternoon, but it's a good question. So in the context of a 2HDM, for instance, this would apply. In fact, it would apply for any number of extra doublets. So you need to share the coupling of the Higgs to Z and W's amongst all the Higgs. And now it looks like this little Higgs that we found is taking most of the coupling, and that the other one would not couple very strongly if we had a two Higgs doublet model, two W's or Z's.
But aren't you imposing this condition on the system interval rather than the central body?
Imposing the...
I think you're imposing this condition on the two sigma interval, not on the central body. But it would make sense to say kappa V plus two sigma cannot be greater than one.
Mm-hmm. It could be.
You're never two sigma away from greater than one.
Yeah. But we're not two sigma away anyway. Now I'll try to find out. So I mean kappa Z is certainly lower, but.
So are there any? What are the big things that are planned for round two?
Hmm?
What are the big measurements that are planned for round two?
Well, for the standard model, we want to see a clear evidence of TTH. So we're in the process of combining with CMS, and the measured signal strength is rather high, and so it will be interesting to see if that goes down to one or if it stays high. And eventually observe this production mode. We haven't. We want to see mu mu in particular. And then we're going to do a more sophisticated analysis. So up until now, this kappa framework is a leading order framework, and we're discussing how to do more complicated interpretations in the context potentially of effective field theories, where you take into account the rates but the differential distributions, to try to see if you have higher order operators that are contributing to the kinematics or the rate. Or do it a little bit like what Lepp did and use pseudo-observables like we saw yesterday in the electroweak plots, where you have RB. So you can focus on some observables that are potentially interesting and sensitive to deviations or new physics. And so this is being discussed within the context of the LHC cross-section working group. So it's a big group of theorists and people from ATLAS and CMS who developed, in fact, this initial framework. And now we're at the limit of what this framework can do, because once you're at the 10% level, and we're almost there, essentially, it doesn't exactly make sense because it's leading order. You're not taking into account the fact that through loops, say the top quark is contributing to another channel. So this is going to get a bit more complicated and at some level interesting. I think what people want to do is in the next 3 years is see if there's anything else out there. Which I haven't discussed. And if there's nothing else out there, in parallel, we have this program of precision measurements. So this we've seen. So we have we've started to make measurements. So this is all about statistics, because you need a lot of energy. Yeah. And so this is related to one of the slides that I showed, is you want to show that the scattering of W's at very high energy is under control, is what you expect, that the Higgs is doing its job. Okay.
Is there a plan to differentiate the minus and plus kappa? For, let's say, the
Yeah, well, the ZZ channel in particular.
Or like Tennessee, for example, degeneracy, right, in the plus or minus.
So yeah, with some, eventually with statistics, we should be able to do so.
So that's what it comes down to,
Yeah, it depends on the size of the interference. Like in these cases, right now, down to up, you see that there's not a lot of a lot you can do. This is lepton quark. But for others, when we looked at, for instance, when you put it, everything together, then you're able to resolve. But there are assumptions in here, of course, that all the vectors couple with the same strength and all the fermions couple with the same strength. And then when you put all this together, you can at least resolve this that sign. It depends also on the assumptions that you make.
Well, would you place any kind of consistency constraints on all those couples? I don't think they can all be independent in a unitary theory.
Is it? I mean, for the you're talking about vectors or the fermions?
Well, already all the fermions.
Yeah, the top cannot be too large.
Right.
Yeah. Any of them cannot be too large.
Right.
But would anything prevent them from being small? Yeah, you need to give them mass in some way.
But when you do this statistical fit, do you just have, I guess you don't use Bayesian inference, right?
No, you can, if you have constraints that you wanted to put in the fit, you can. And then, you know, we impose all kinds of different constraints and assumptions. And you can relax them. At some point, you have too many parameters floating around. So this is our most general fit, like I mentioned. And here we can only do ratios. There are things that you can do at a linear collider where you can measure some of the coupling. So we're always at this. That was the point of what I was showing here, but what we're measuring is this product always, right? And so it would be nice to have a direct coupling measurement, but we don't. So we need to make some assumptions or put different measurements together. Here we can play the game where we cancel the branching ratios. We have two production channels that go to the same final state. So you do the ratio of the two. You do not depend on the branching ratio. So in terms of ratios, we can do well. But
how much lower is the next production channel
after pH? It's mu mu. It's the next we'll see, and then z gamma.
And how much longer does that take to see anything?
Mu mu, we'll see what the machine delivers in the next 3 years. But at the end, I was saving the slide for a bit later. So here are the projections. So this is for run 3. So that would be in 2020, early 2020s. And this is the high luminosity LHC, if we ever go there. So you can see this is the uncertainty on mu at 300, so it's about 40%. So you're starting to see a signal, but it's not very significant. And eventually, on our way to a very large data set, you know, we would have five sigma. We should start to see something probably in run two. So this is the period between now and 2018, next 3 years of running. Some hint. Yeah. Well, there's BB instead of so you can go through two Bs fusing, for instance. But we haven't looked at it. I think beyond TTH, it's quite hard. In BSM models, you can get enhancements of the A Higgs to say BB, and then so we're looking for evidence of that type of production. But you can see from so you need to take something inside a proton or emit something off a quark or gluon, like a W. So it needs to live in the proton. And Okay, thanks.